This is Norman B's Life Elsewhere, the show about art, media, and culture.
Hello there. Welcome to Life Elsewhere. I'm Norman B. In this edition, two guests and two important topics. Later in the program, Yale professor Jason Stanley will talk about his new book, How Fascism Works, The Politics of Us and Them. Now, I don't want you to miss this conversation because I asked the professor if fascism is part of the human makeup and what part does religion play in fascism. First, my conversation with the former president of Scientology's International Humanitarian Organization. Her name is Michelle LeClaire. She fell in love with a woman and tried to split from the church. But this came at a terrible price. Her once pristine reputation was publicly dragged through the mud. The police raided her home. Her ex-husband tried to gain full custody of their children. And the multi-million dollar business she built from scratch totally destroyed. Michelle has written a memoir to offer an insider's perspective on Scientology. The title, perfectly clear. Escaping Scientology and Fighting for the Woman I Love. Michelle LeClaire is with us to talk about her book. Michelle, welcome to Life Elsewhere.
Thank you, Norman, for having me.
So the title, Perfectly Clear, sounds all very, very nice. It's very just a nice title. And then we get to the subtitle, Escaping Scientology and Fighting for the Woman I Love. I read the book over last weekend. I got to tell you, it kind of stopped me in my tracks for a moment for a number of reasons. One, I think it's just it's a wonderful love story. And two, I know a little bit about Scientology, but not a lot. So I'm going to start with asking you, why did you write this book in the first place?
Well, I think that everything that I went through in Scientology, I kept asking myself for so many years of struggling after I had left, why is this happening to me? And I had to believe that I had a story that needed to be known. If I could help one person not walk through the doors of the Church of Scientology, if I could help one person leave Scientology, if I could help one person walk out of an abusive marriage, then it would be worth it. And I felt like it was something that I needed to expose.
So let's get down to the basics, shall we? You joined Scientology because of your mother. Your mother was involved in Scientology, that's right?
Right. So my mother and I moved from Oklahoma to California in the late 80s. We knew nothing about Scientology or L. Ron Hubbard. She started working for a management consulting company in California. They happened to be the largest recruiter to the Church of Scientology at that time, and we had no idea.
When I read that, and some of the other things you write in your book, is one of the areas that we as the general layman, the public, don't really know, that not involved in Scientology, the kind of things that they do. So can we go into that just a little bit? Is that, I guess let's start off with talking about really what is Scientology, because I think this is the mystery for a lot of people.
Well, I think people like Leah Remini and, Alex Gibney, who did the documentary Going Clear, Lawrence Wright, who did his book, really explain the details of Scientology. They believe that there are two sides. One is that in Dianetics, they talk about that there is a reactive mind. It's the side of your mind that is recording painful events that are happening to you, painful emotion. And those things hold you back in life. Well, that may all sound fine and good, but the problem is that they have a way of dealing with that, and it is called auditing. And you sit down with somebody who is called an auditor, one who listens, but you have a device in between the two of you, which is like a lie detector. And you're holding these cans with a tiny bit of an electrical current that is going through them, and it is attached to something called the E-meter. And that E-meter is supposed to register thought. So they believe that there are thoughts that are below the conscious level that the E-meter can detect with the right questions from the auditor that will help you get rid of this past pain. Here's the lie about all of it. That auditor is directing you in areas that the church wants you to be directed in. And sometimes those areas are not even true areas for you. Or sometimes if you're directed to an area that may be very painful, something horrible has happened to you. A child has been molested, there's been rape, maybe somehow you've been hurt or harmed. the church will keep directing you into believing that you caused that to happen, and it is your fault, and what have you done? What did you do to that person to put yourself in that situation in the first place?
You know, as I was reading that explanation in your book, I'm thinking that in a way it's a more overt sort of idea than other religions that we know of, because most religions kind of direct you in some way or another. There's lots of sort of manipulation, and I'm not going to use the word skullduggery, although I just did, but there does seem to be. But with Scientology, this is the part that I think confuses me, and I think confuses most people. And even after reading your book, I still have to ask the question, do you think that the people involved in Scientology these days, and L. Ron Hubbard, really did believe in helping people and being, I don't know, just sort of generously good? Or what was there a sort of an underlying motive that was just not a good idea?
Yeah, I don't believe that anybody that is running the Church of Scientology or L. Ron Hubbard believed in doing good. I think he found a way to control people, to hypnotize people, and to brainwash people. And that's how you held on to them. And if you could hold on to them, then they're going to give you their last dime,
yeah,
because they believe in it, and you will make billions, which is what they're sitting on. The individual Scientologist that are in the church today, or people like myself, we believed that we were doing good. We believed that we had come up with something that was the secret to the universe. We were going to better ourselves, and we were going to better mankind. But you constantly are questioning them. But when you question them because something doesn't make sense, then you get into trouble.
You know, as I'm reading your book, I'm feeling for you, and that you get involved, and you're believing, you're really taking it all for, this is something that your life is now built around, but you're losing money as you're going along. Let's talk about that very briefly, about,
yes,
the fact that you had lots of money, and all of a sudden you didn't.
So I was lucky enough to build one of the largest woman-owned insurance agencies in the nation at the time. And my company was making millions of dollars. I was dealing with high net worth individuals, and I was giving millions of dollars to the Church of Scientology. When I decided that I would finally be my true self, and I fell in love with a woman, I believed so much in the church that I thought, well, yes, I tried to come out at 19. They had me read all these things that L. Ron Hubbard had said about gay people and that we were not good. But you know what? It's been 20 years.
Mm.
And not only has there been a progression in the world on gay rights, but maybe I could be the rainbow flag waving Scientologist.
Yeah, right. Yeah. So you must have known other people. I want to get into this a little deeper here, Michelle. Well, let me tell everybody, we're talking to Michelle LeClaire. Her book is called Perfectly Clear, Escaping Scientology and Fighting for the Woman I Love. So you knew at 19 that you probably liked ladies rather than you did men.
I did. I didn't have any boyfriends in high school. I was attracted to women, but I didn't know anybody who,
yeah,
was gay.
Yes.
And I didn't really understand it.
Now, did you, when you were involved in Scientology, for the time that you were involved, did you have any ideas that anybody else was gay? Did you get any feelings that somebody could have been?
Not until the very end.
Yeah.
I did not know one single person who I thought was gay or hinted at being gay until I actually came out to the church. And there were about 2 months where I was very out and still going to get together, you know, showing up at get-togethers with people that were Scientologists.
Right.
And a handful of women came up to me and said, oh my God, this is so amazing. The church hasn't done anything to you since you've come out. I want to let you know that I'm gay, and I've been in love with a woman for all these years, but I was also forced to be married, and I'm going to divorce. You've given me strength, and I'm going to divorce. Every single one of those women I never heard from again, and from my understanding are still in the church and not living their true self.
Now, what was the reasoning that they gave you for being against you being gay?
Well, they were never that open about it. They would say to my face, that we will not get involved in relationships. But then I would be taken in session and asked detail after detail after detail about my thoughts, my experiences. And when I would come out of session, I would be made to read things that L. Ron Hubbard has written about gay people. And, you know, one of the lines that just sent chills down my back was not only in Dianetics, where he talks about that they should be taken out of society, but yeah. also in Science of Survival, he literally says, dispose of them quietly and without sorrow.
Wow. That's so unsettling, isn't it? It really is.
It is. It was very scary to think that you believed in something wholeheartedly and you have dedicated your entire life and they have told you that there is no stance on this. But then you're made to read those things. And it is that quiet little smile of the person across from you with their wide-eyed stare.
Yeah.
And they have you read that you know you are not safe.
Now, there's levels in Scientology. I happen to live, even though this show goes out all over the place, all over the world, in fact, I live in an area where there is a huge, big Scientology headquarters. And I often see them walking around, as I say, see them. I mean, there's people just walking up and down the street, it looks to me, in uniforms. And it just really is very odd. Can you talk about that?
So L. Ron Hubbard, from what I've learned now, and you know, look, Leah Remini has forged the path for us and has really helped bring truth to those of us that have left.
Yeah.
You know, Leah's got a great website where she talks about how L. Ron Hubbard was actually trying to stay away from governments that were coming after him because of some of the things that he was doing inside the Church of Scientology. So he bought a ship and he went out into international waters where, you know, no governmental agencies could get a hold of him.
Yeah.
And he ended up creating a church out there, and it was called the Sea Organization. And he ran it as if it was a naval ship and people were in uniform. Once he was able to come back into the United States and start this organization in the United States, and which has ultimately gone everywhere, he still kept that. And people that worked directly for the Church of Scientology would wear uniforms that look like Navy uniform.
Yeah. It's so very strange. I have been invited to some social events at the very big headquarters near, not too far from where I live, by the Scientologists. And for all intents and purposes, everything seems like just a normal, almost like a big fancy charity function. You know the kind of thing with lots of...
Oh, yes.
Yeah. And I've been invited to these things. And on a couple of occasions I've been. But the really disturbing and unsettling thing is that everybody seems to have this sort of... The only way I can describe it is a kind of grin on their face the whole time. Am I imagining things?
No, you're not. I mean, you can pick them out all over. Look, when I was doing my, you know, first PR run in New York, when the book has first came out last week, they were all over my hotel and following me everywhere.
Really?
You could pick them out in 2 seconds.
Yeah.
You know, you were taught in the very beginning something called training routines, where you have to learn how to sit perfectly still and not make a move except to barely blink for 2 hours.
Wow.
And that is one of the first training routines that you do so that you cannot be thrown off kilter with anything. And L. Ron Hubbard also believes that any human emotion and reaction stems from things that you were withholding or you're not being honest from. So as a Scientologist, you're trained to just kind of stand there, don't make a lot of movement, and don't show a lot of emotion because emotion is not important. And you were literally taught to be a robot.
You mentioned this, you talk about this in your book, and I'm wondering as I'm reading that, I wondered if at the time, and even now looking back, did you feel like you were being manipulated? Did you feel like you were being brainwashed?
I think as I got older, you know, they really prey on younger people.
Yeah.
Because you're very naive. And especially people that are not looking for a traditional religion.
Ah, yes, yeah.
And so they prey on that. And when you're younger, you just like all the attention and the accolades, and they prey on the ego. Mm. And they make you believe that their definition of success is how well you're known, what is your PR like, how much money are you making? And what I started to learn over the years and having children is that they would tell me that emotion was not important. But I started to question, how could I live life without love?
Yes.
And I had this undying love for my children, but I had a loveless marriage.
Yes.
And had a painful marriage. But yet, I was never allowed to show that to the public eye.
Now you're
and I started to question that.
Yeah. Now you're happy in your life now. You've got your children with you, and you've got your partner with you. Things are well for you now?
Oh, they are. I live out on a farm. I have the love of my life right next to me. I have four beautiful, amazing children. I am free thinking. I can study any religion practice that I want.
Yes.
And it's a very, very blessed life. You know, my definition of success is very different now. It is, how hard do I love? How kind am I to others and accepting? And if I'm blessed to have another great career ahead of me, that's a wonderful thing, but
yes.
I never want to be defined by that again.
Was writing this book really helpful to you? Did it clear out a lot of sort of, I don't know, questions? I'm sure it must have been at times, putting it together, a little painful. I'm positive about that.
It was both. I mean, it was extremely painful to go through some of the most painful moments. I think what was one of the most difficult things to do is that I started writing this book years after I left. So I had finally gotten my brain to the place where I wasn't thinking like a Scientologist any longer.
Yeah.
I wasn't using all of the terminology. And I was trying to forget all those things that I had been taught. So to go back and try and remember those things, or to try and talk as a Scientologist again, I think that was something that was very difficult for me.
Yeah. There's just one last thing I've got to touch on before, because we've only got, as always with these situations, only have a certain amount of time. It's wonderful to talk to you. The book is called Perfectly Clear, Escaping Scientology and Fighting for the Woman I Love. Michelle LeClair is my guest. Another sort of little reference for me, a personal reference about Scientology, and this is just a bit of an obscure thing, really, but I just wanted to share it with you. And many years ago, I was in New York, and I, because of the profession that I was in then and now, I got invited to a lot of different functions, and I was invited to a big fancy schmancy dinner one night. And a young man walked in on the arm of another man, a very celebrated man on Broadway. And this man, I've got to explain, this is many, many years ago, but this young man that came in on the arm of another man now is a huge, huge, great big star, and he's in Scientology. And I just wondered, but there's been sort of rumors and stories and whatever, but he's never actually come out and said anything about his predilection. And I just wondered about people hiding things like that, and that sort of that celebrity side of things. Any thoughts on that?
Well, there are different rules for their celebrities.
Ah.
And they rewrite the rules for their celebrities. So I cannot tell you, I'm very aware of who you're talking about, but
yeah.
I cannot tell you personally that I have had any experience or seen anything like that with this person. I can only tell you from my experience that being gay was not allowed inside the Church of Scientology, and I have never seen that person or any other people walk hand in hand with someone of the same sex.
Yes.
My feeling is that it was approached the same way, and the church believes you've had many bodies, many lifetimes, and so you're just confused, but you better get straight this lifetime.
Right.
And I feel sad. I feel sad for those people that are still there. I feel sad for the fact that they're having to live a life that is not true to them.
Yeah.
And I hope to God one day they get out.
I wish we had more time, because there's a lot of questions I'd like to ask you about just like the mental state of people and drinking and drugs and sex and rock and roll.
And they don't allow any of it.
Any of it, right.
Yeah.
We have been talking to Michelle LeClair. The book is called Perfectly Clear. It is a very interesting read, Escaping Scientology and Fighting for the Woman I Love. Good luck to you and to your family. I really enjoyed talking with you, Michelle.
Thank you, Norman, so much. I enjoyed it too.
Now, here's a reminder. If you want to hear this edition of Life Elsewhere again, you have a number of options. There's the different outlets that air Life Elsewhere, or you can go to NPR One, iTunes, Stitcher, and Mixcloud. All the details are conveniently located at lifeelsewhere.co. And don't forget that your input and feedback is always welcome. Write to info@lifeelsewhere.co. Still to come in the show, my conversation with Yale professor Jason Stanley on his new book, How Fascism Works, right after this.
You're listening to the best show on radio about art, media, and culture. Life Elsewhere with Norman B.
Diamond in the back, sun rooftop, digging in the scene with the gasoline. Ooh, ooh.
The book is called How Fascism Works, The Politics of Us and Them. The author, Jason Stanley. Jason, welcome to Life Elsewhere.
Thank you so much.
I have to be honest with you, and this is almost, I've been thinking about this on the ride to the studio this morning. I was thinking, how am I going to explain to Jason that I didn't want to read your book?
I didn't want to write the book.
Yeah, and that's kind of what I was thinking that you might say. And you understand why I didn't want to read it. I knew in some respects, I knew in parts what you were going to tell me. And a lot of what you say is what I already sort of knew, but how you've put it together really makes for very interesting reading. You're telling something which is very appropriate to read and understand right now and talk about. You, in your book, and the title tells it all, doesn't it? How Fascism Works, The Politics of Us and Them. But you break everything down into what you call 10 pillars of fascist politics. My first question to you, Jason, is, how difficult was it for you to break it down into those 10 pillars?
It was not that difficult. I mean, you know, I think it could have been 9 pillars. It could have been 11 pillars.
Yeah.
So there was some maneuvering. But I thought that it quite naturally, those 10 pillars etched themselves into the structure of rhetoric. For instance, when I realized that across the world, in fact, leaders who exhibit fascist tendencies talk about the heartland and the real voters, the real nation lives in the heartland, and the rural areas and the cities are dens of iniquity. You know, those were surprising things to me to discover how universal themes like that were. So, you know, when I started, maybe I thought there would be 4 or 5 pillars, but I ended up with 10.
Right. So here we are, How Fascism Works, and I'm just going to sort of make a presumption here that you started to put ideas down for this book when we had a change in government in the United States. Is that right?
My previous book was called How Propaganda Works.
Right.
It was the culmination of about 5 years of research on propaganda. And I'd been thinking about the changes, disturbing changes in our politics for some time. My first New York Times piece ever in 2011 was on birtherism. So I've been, you know, Fox News alarmed me, the Iraq War alarmed me, the torture scandals alarmed me. So I had been thinking about these themes for a very long time, and How Fascism Works is really the sort of trade book crystallized version of the academic work I've done on propaganda.
So let's get into the book a little bit. You've broken it down, as we said, into 10 pillars of fascist politics, basically the chapters. In the anti-intellectual chapter, you talk about somebody called David Horowitz. I think this is important that we talk about David Horowitz. Can you give us more information?
David Horowitz is someone who started out actually left-wing a long time ago, and then he switched and became far right. And he, early on in the 1990s, he started targeting universities as dens of leftist ideology. And he targeted them quite harshly with various movements to to press universities to hire people with views that were more sympathetic to his own, very right-wing views. He published a couple books about dangerous professors. The first book was sort of filled with Middle Eastern studies professors. He's rabidly right-wing on Israeli politics, so he's very Likud. His second book of dangerous professors was a lot of women's studies professors. So that's one thing you find across the world: these attacks on gender studies, on liberalism and feminism, and the idea that universities are advancing liberalism and feminism and wearing down the traditions of the nation. He also helped train a number of members of the Trump administration. So Stephen Miller is a protege of his,
right.
So the harsh anti-immigration advisor. So we're seeing a lot of Horowitz's tactics and politics come to fruition. He sort of perfected the attacking universities for saying that, for chilling free speech it's this sort of weird idea that you see in the mainstream now that universities are incubators of leftist ideology, and the very just having Middle Eastern studies departments or black studies departments somehow is anti-free speech.
You know, there's a word there that you just said, which often whenever I hear that phrase, and the word is incubators, whenever I hear somebody use that in a sentence, it always seems to me it's very deliberate and very provocative. It seems like, how did you come up with the word incubator? And I'm not asking you, I mean, I'm talking about whoever's speaking, like Horowitz or whoever. It does seem, it's a very provocative word, isn't it?
It is, yeah. I mean, I used it because that's how they're representing universities. That's whenever you find fascist politics, you find attacks on the media and universities and culture for being sort of incubators of leftism and liberalism.
Yes.
So that's a absolutely common tactic.
Right.
In they're closing universities in Eastern Europe for teaching gender studies and liberalism and being pro-immigrant. And spreading liberal values. So in Hungary, for instance, and Russia. So we've had that here for two decades already. We've had attacks on queer studies, and actually we exported some of that to Eastern Europe rather than vice versa.
That's interesting, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, it's sort of similar with some of our. There was press about this with the Ugandan anti-gay laws that harshly punished, I think, the death penalty for homosexuality,
right.
Which were sort of fostered by some of our far-right Christian right here. So you have some of the same happening with the attack on the harsh anti-gay laws in Russia, which sort of, you know, came way after that kind of politics emerged in the United States.
We're talking to Yale professor Jason Stanley. His new book is called How Fascism Works, The Politics of Us and Them. He's broken down his argument into 10 chapters, 10 pillars of fascist politics. I'm going to now go to unreality. Donald Trump, you write, came to mainstream political attention by attacking the press for their supposed censorship of conspiracy theory called birtherism. Now, you've written about this quite extensively. Let's just get into the birtherism thing, can we?
Mm-hmm.
Where did that really start from? It didn't come out of thin air, did it?
No, I think what conspiracy theories do is they sort of take some kind of inchoate fear and they crystallize it in a narrative that seemingly makes sense of that fear. So the fear here is that President Obama was a mysterious foreigner, someone who's corrupting the natural order of things. So the way you sort of concretize that is by saying that he's secretly born in Kenya and secretly a Muslim. And then you raise the suspicion that everything is actually not what it seems. And he's completely untrustworthy because his entire career is based on this complete lie. And he's really some kind, and you're feeling that he's foreign and strange. You're feeling that this disrupts the natural order to have a black man like him be president of the United States. Your feeling is somehow legitimate, because really it is all some sort of secret plot.
Was there really behind this? And I'm wondering that maybe I'm just being fanciful about this and thinking it's just too clever and too... The whole idea really was to not actually say black, but to say something other than that. And so birtherism came to be. And basically, it was just saying this is a black man and we don't want a black man as president.
Right. And it was a bit more complicated because President Obama is, of course, half East African.
Yeah.
And so Kenya is sort of raises these thoughts of strange, you know, exotic, you know, East African. There aren't that many East Africans in the United States. So, the whole thing is bizarre because, of course, the Luo, President Obama's father's tribe, isn't, most of them are Christian anyway. But the idea was to sort of wrap up Muslims and
yes.
Everything Americans are frightened of
right.
in one neat bow. You know, Islam, foreigners, blackness, Africa,
right.
So and put it all together. The structure of the conspiracy theory worked as all conspiracy theories do, as the Protocols of Elders of Zion worked. What you do is you say, the press is not reporting on this, therefore they're part of the conspiracy.
So
you catch the press in a trap.
Yes.
This is exactly what happened in Nazi Germany with the Protocols of the Elders of Zion. They said that the press is controlled by Jews. And the evidence that the press was controlled by the Jews was that the press was not reporting on the fact that the press was controlled by Jews.
Yes.
So then the press is in this trap.
Yes.
If it doesn't report on it, then it's part of the conspiracy. If it does report on it, then it gives the conspiracy legitimacy that it should not have.
You know, I'm laughing, but I'm not laughing seriously, I guess, because it's so it's absurdist at the same time as being kind of funny. The thing that Trump did was that he used the birtherism idea to really push himself forward. Do you think, have you got any thoughts about whether when he was doing this, this was done intentionally to run? Because he started doing this way before he started to run for office.
2012.
Yeah.
2011, 2012. I think Timothy Snyder, my colleague, argues that it originated in Russia.
Ah, yeah.
The specific conspiracy theory, the birtherism, originated in Russia and then was promulgated to the United States. And then Mr. Trump, in 2011 and 2012, really pushed it and used it to move into the national political scene.
So does that give us another conspiracy idea that Trump got it from the Russians?
I think that's my colleague Timothy Snyder's view.
Yeah.
I'm not enough of a scholar of that
right.
to say. I mean, I have read Snyder's work and find it plausible, but it's not my area of expertise.
Right. I'm going to go off on a tangent right now, if you don't mind. We're talking to Jason Stanley. His book is called How Fascism Works, The Politics of Us and Them. Jason, I'm just literally going to go off on a tangent, and that's we don't know, of course, all the findings of Mueller right now, but we are going to find out sooner or later. Just giving me a hunch on this. Are we going to, the whole Russia connection, is that going to be exposed in the way that we're sort of fearful of?
Well, I think it's already been exposed.
So,
I mean, it's all out in the open.
Okay.
I mean, well, we know that Mr. Trump, has had decades-long connections with the Russian mafia, which is very similar, overlaps with the Russian state. We know that many of the apartments in Trump Towers, for instance, were bought by companies. I mean, this is all not my research. This is other people's research, but it's all out in the open. So I'm not really sure. And the American people, many of his supporters have suggested they don't care. I mean, I saw some of his supporters at a rally wearing T-shirts, "I'd rather be Russian than a Democrat."
Yes.
So,
yes.
You know, that's part of the changing of reality.
Yes.
So we have a situation where I think a lot of his core supporters are going back on tenets of American patriotism,
right?
Like sovereignty.
I want to talk about law and order. We're going to do that after a quick break.
This is Life Elsewhere, hosted by Norman B. Let us know what you think of our show. Send your comments to info@lifeelsewhere.co. That's C-O.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Jason Stanley. He has a new book. It's called How Fascism Works, The Politics of Us and Them. He lists 10 pillars of fascist politics. And one of those pillars is titled Law and Order. And one area that I focused in on, you're talking about the reporting of the what happened in Baltimore with Freddie Gray. And you go into quite great detail about how CNN used the word protest and MSNBC used protest and then they used riot, the difference in the words that they used. Can you talk about that, Jason?
So there's a long history in the United States of representing black political protests as riots. Now, of course, what you do in doing that is you take, suppose you have a large protest and a couple people act badly, act violently, then you just focus on them and you call it a riot. And you ignore the fact that the whole thing was a protest. Catherine Bigelow's movie Detroit shows this. I mean, you know, all Americans are raised with the idea that there were these riots in Detroit. And I was raised without knowing why there were people on the street in Detroit and why there were military, the whole city was militarized. Well, it's because it was a protest against police brutality. That we just got a rerun of that in Baltimore. So the issue is whether you describe things as a protest or a riot. James Baldwin says, in his piece, Negroes are anti-Semitic because they're anti-white. He says the boys and girls in Watts and Harlem realized that in the Warsaw Ghetto they were represented as heroes, while they were represented, as rioters. So in Baltimore, Fox News used the word riot to describe what was happening in Baltimore. I think 7 words out of 1,000 and protest 2 words out of 1,000. CNN used riot at around the same level as protest, like 3.5 words per 1,000. And MSNBC used protest more than riot to describe what was happening in Baltimore. And so you see a very strong effect of describing the same events. If you describe them as riots, you create one political picture.
Yes.
If you describe them as protests, you create quite another political picture.
This is such an interesting area because this then ties back to your previous book, How Propaganda Works, which I read after How Fascism Works, I should tell you. They're companion pieces. Now let's move to another.
And I should note, I have a forthcoming book with Princeton with the linguist David Beaver called Hustle, The Politics of Language, which is a huge academic track on rhetoric.
Oh, good.
On all of this.
Oh, God, we're really into that. Oh, great. We have to talk to you about that, get you back on. Now let's go to an area that I think is just fascinating because of all the connotation. Sodom and Gomorrah, and you say, in fascist ideology, the rural life is guided by an ethos of self-sufficiency which breeds strength. In rural communities, one does not need to depend on the state, unlike the parasites in the city. Let's talk about that.
So, again, in Nazi ideology, Jews were lazy. They lived off interest that they got from loaning money. The hardworking Germans earned the money, and Jews were just lazy and lived off the state because the state protected their lending practices. So the idea was you should force Jews to work for free. That's why the gates of Auschwitz said, Arbeit macht frei, work shall make you free, one reason. So there's this idea that people in the rural areas, they're hardworking, they work to earn their money. And then people in the cities, they're just lounging around collecting. Hitler in Chapter 2 of Mein Kampf complains about all the state funding going to the arts to support sort of lazy, decadent artists in the city. And the idea, and time after time, you find that the out-group, whatever that out-group is across the world, are supposed to be lazy. They're supposed to be lazy, decadent, and criminal. So it was very surprising to me. It was surprising to me to see these education textbooks from the 1930s in Germany showing soft Jewish hands. That has not worked, and of course in the United States. So, and sort of across the world, we find group in many, many fascist movements, the out-group lives in the city. So this is, this is a revelation to me, because the expression inner city in American English is code word for a place where black people live. Well, the cities were the place where the Jews were supposed to live in Nazi ideology, in Romanian fascist ideology as well. Mm. So Hitler in chapter 2 of Mein Kampf says in Vienna, Jews, Jews, and more Jews, he says of the capital city of Austria, Vienna. So this idea that the cities are places where people sort of lounge about engaging in homosexuality and decadence and living off the state, and in the rural areas, people are working hard and honest workers. That's a leitmotif of fascist politics.
Yale professor Jason Stanley is my guest. His book is How Fascism Works, The Politics of Us and Them. Jason, as you were putting this book together, you're gathering all your information. Was there at one point when you were surprised by some of the research that you were doing? Was there anything that sort of caught your attention? You went, I really hadn't thought of that.
Yeah, well, I think a number of things. First, that all across the world, whatever the group is, the out group is, they're lazy. They're supposed to be lazy. They're supposed to be criminal. And they're supposed to be rape threats to your women. So the Rohingya men, the crisis that has resulted in what looks to be a genocide, certainly an ethnic cleansing in Myanmar, was started because three Rohingya men raped a Rankine woman in 2012. So they were all locked up in villages for years, and 6 years later they started to be slaughtered. 5 years later they started to be slaughtered. In the Hindutva nationalist movement, tars Muslim men as rape threats to Hindu women. So in the United States, our history of lynching reveals this. There was what Angela Davis calls the myth of the black rapist, that black men posed this existential threat to white women. So and Mr. Trump today with his constant linking of immigrants and rape. So the laziness thing, the idea that the group that's being attacked is always a lazy drain on the state. Immigrants are supposed to be both lazy yet here to take our jobs, which is of course a paradox. But the rural, the politics of the rural-urban divide, the Sodom and Gomorrah chapter, that the city and the hardworking country is always this central motif. But I knew about the fact that, the group that's being attacked is always represented as criminals, that law and order in fascist politics always means the out-group are criminals by their nature.
Yeah.
But I guess I was surprised by the laziness, that the out-group is always supposed to be lazy. Jews were radically represented as lazy in
yes.
Nazi ideology.
Yes.
And it's just so similar with anti-black racism here.
As I'm reading your book, I'm thinking, and I was thinking again as I'm driving into the studio today, I was thinking, is fascism part of us? Is it something which is, I'm not saying you and I, but I mean as humans, what do you think?
Yes. So I think the very particular structure of 20th century fascism requires something that happened in the 19th century, namely nationalism. Mm. So the ideology of hyper-nationalism. That creates a mythic past that for which we feel nostalgia. So my book has 10 features, 10 pillars of fascism. And I think that there is a structure minus certain particularities that is part of being human, that you find Plato warning us about in Book 8 of the Republic. So in Book 8 of the Republic, Plato says, democracy will immediately lead to tyranny because democracy's freedoms allow for freedom of speech. And fascist I am for freedom of speech. Mm. But I also think I'm also for recognizing its dangers.
Yes.
When you have freedom of speech and you have a lot of resentment in a society generated by inequality, then, as Plato warns us, a demagogue can come and set one group against the other and represent themselves as the protector of his supporters. Mm. And Plato says that's the risk in democracy. So you always have, you know, Goebbels says this, that's the beginning of my How Propaganda Works book, the quote, it will always be the best joke of democracy that its freedoms led to the victory by its greatest enemy.
Yes.
What fascists do is they exploit the democracy's freedoms and say, hey, you know, you have to allow us to engage in hate speech because of free speech, and then they use it to create resentment and divides and seize power and end democracy. And that is as old as human civilization.
Right. So I guess the next question then is, will it always be with us?
It will always be with us. It will. It's democracy that's hard to retain. It will always be with us as long as we tolerate large divisions. Mm. When we have large divisions, either racial divisions, gender divisions, or between rich and poor, then people will become resentful of each other. And when they become resentful of each other, that can be exploited. So the history of political philosophy tells us this. It says democracy can only work if people feel like a collective, if people feel kinship with each other, if people are not harshly resentful of each other. And large economic inequality creates those resentments.
I guess we could say that it's like the schoolyard, isn't it? I mean, you see these kind of, there's always the bully, and there's always the sort of, there's the gangs on one side and the loners on another side. It's the human nature, isn't it? It's really kind of sad in some respects.
Well, you have the extra element with fascist politics of mass politics. So when you have someone up on the stage in rallies, gathering people into, like, sort of whipping people up into feeling incredible resentment and fear and loss. So
yes.
Fascism, a mark of fascism is always this incredible feeling of victimization, and that's different from the schoolyard. A mark of fascism is when the dominant group feels that it's the greatest victim. So many of Trump's supporters think that white Christian men are the most discriminated against group in America. So
You've just led me into a question that I wanted to get to, and that was, and it's headed, well, it's just one word, actually. It is religion. How much religion plays into your story?
It's a great question. I think, like, so for me, fascist politics is a sliding scale. You can have more or less fascist politics. I think ultimately, Christianity gave us the concept of human rights. And human rights is inconsistent with fascism, because fascism is based on social Darwinism, that when you hear people talking about winners and losers, makers and takers, then you know you're dealing with social Darwinism. You're dealing with one part of fascist ideology. And no self-respecting Christian should divide the world into winners and losers. However, Christianity and most religions, Islam, Judaism, most Hinduism, have a hierarchical structure where there's an authority figure, God,
yeah.
And the structure is that people are subservient to that authority figure. So patriarchy, authority, those are loyalty, blind faith, those are religious ideals for many religions. And those ideals also overlap with fascist ideals. Now, there's aspects to fascism that are flatly inconsistent with Christianity. Christianity has given us the concept of human rights, and that's flatly inconsistent. We find human rights under assault from Hungary to the United States to Russia to India. So it's tricky. So there are certain fascist ideals that, you know, the sort of absolutist authority, the authority over truth. But there are other fascist aspects to fascist ideology that aren't consistent. So it's a delicate balance here.
You know, I often ask authors when I'm talking to them if they enjoyed writing their book. I'm I'm not sure whether I should ask you that or not.
My parents are themselves refugees from anti-Semitism in Europe, both survivors of the Holocaust, yeah. Though not in camps. And so I grew up in a household being warned by aspects of the United States that reminded my parents of what they experienced in Europe. Baldwin says in that piece I referred to, Negroes are anti-Semitic because they're anti-white. He says, it's addressed to Jewish people and his fellow black Americans. He says, you think you're closer to us because of our shared history of oppression, but our shared history of oppression is why we resent you more, because we know you're lucky not to be us. And my mother worked in Manhattan criminal court, and she often noted the way that black Americans were targeted in the way that she, as a Polish Jew, is targeted. So I feel like this time is actually a somewhat hopeful time, weirdly. It's a time where we can go back and maybe confront some of the aspects of our society that enabled what we're now seeing. Because maybe now we can see, as long as we let these things fester, anti-black racism, homophobia, patriarchy, economic inequality, we let ourselves open to this.
Yes.
And maybe it's a time where we can actually go back and say, let's make ourselves not vulnerable to this and address some of the long-standing fissures in American society that enabled what we are now seeing.
I love that. I love that you ended there on a note of optimism. I really appreciate that. We have been talking to Jason Stanley. His book is called How Fascism Works, The Politics of Us and Them. Before I let you go, Jason, I guess I'd be remiss if I didn't ask you just a little reference. We've made a few, of course, but to Mr. Trump and where we are right now, I don't want you to be a soothsayer. But I'm just wondering, in your learned, with all the knowledge that you have and having written this book, just give me a little overview, if you wouldn't mind, just very, very briefly, of how you think things are going to sort of pan out from where we are right now.
Well, my concern I agree with President Obama that President Trump is more a symptom than a cause, a symptom of a lot of ills that have been festering for some time.
Yeah.
My concern right now is that what we face is a one-party state. A minority of Americans voted for this president, a minority of Americans voted for the Senate, and yet we're on the verge of a hard right Republican majority in the Supreme Court for generations to come.
Mm-hmm.
We have massive voter suppression. We face a crisis of democracy where elections might not be as consequential in the future. And President Trump is not seizing fascist control. He's employing the techniques of fascist politics to enrich himself and friends, a cynic might say. But I worry about that we're at the stage where too many of members of the Republican Party are loyal to what Hannah Arendt called party over parties, namely the Republican Party over a multi-party democratic system. And so we need to return loyalty to a multi-party democratic system. And I think this election, upcoming election, is key. And I guess I believe in the American people.
Well, again, another optimistic note there. I have so many other questions I'd love to talk to you about, but unfortunately, of course, time is up against us. We have been talking to Professor Jason Stanley. How Fascism Works, The Politics of Us and Them is his latest book. Jason, thank you so very much for joining us at Life Elsewhere.
Thank you so much. A wonderful discussion. That's sobering.
For more sobering discussions, make sure you go to lifeelsewhere.co to see all the links to hear this and all the editions of Life Elsewhere again. Now, coming up in future editions of Life Elsewhere, we'll talk about one of my favorite subjects, wine, with the author of a new book aptly titled Wine Folly. I'm also going to be speaking to the author of a new book with the ominous title of Trump's Brain. And
If you have ideas for topics or guests, then why not let me know? Write to info@lifeelsewhere.co. Now here's a reminder to check out my other show, cleverly titled Life Elsewhere Music. You can find all the outlets and links again up at lifeelsewhere.co. Just head to the Life Elsewhere Music page. Here then is an example of new music I'll be playing on the next volume. It's Satu with Nightmaring, right here on Life Elsewhere. More info on the other side. That was Sinead Westwork, a.k.a. Satu, out of London, with Nightmaring from her new Growing Up EP. She says she's a rose-tinted singer, and I have no reason to doubt her. Well, thank you to our guests, and thank you for listening. Till next time, be well, be good, and always, it's so easy to do, and it costs absolutely nothing. Be nice. Bye-bye.
You have been listening to Life Elsewhere, created and hosted by Norman B. Life Elsewhere is written and produced by Norman B. Guest booking and additional research by Stephanie Lane. Behind the scenes assistance by James Van, Bruce Goodman, and Allison Klein. We love to hear what you think about Life Elsewhere. Send your questions, queries, and comments to info@lifeelsewhere.co. That's C-O. Life Elsewhere is produced at the studios of WMNF Tampa.